they played Old Anxi at the Black Cat. And all of a sudden, they were in there in plain clothes, grabbing people. Nobody knew who they were yet. The police were beating people in there, beating them down. When you're my age and ready to leave this earth, if you haven't left your community in a better place than you found it, and the world as a whole, you haven't lived.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. An Australian Senate committee steers toward marriage equality, Japan bans LGBTQ harassment by government workers, and honoring the black cat that scratched cops before Stonewall. Those stories and more this week, now that you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending February 18th, 2017. Australian equality advocates were encouraged this week by a cross-party Senate committee report on how to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples. The process had actually started prior to what turned out to be the failed effort to hold a national plebiscite on the issue. Assuming the public vote was in favor, which was expected, the committee was drafting a civil marriage equality bill to then be introduced in Parliament. Greens Senator Janet Rice joined members of the Liberal, Labour, and National parties on the committee, along with the representative from a small group of independent MPs, to issue the report. She described it as an unprecedented show of collaboration, negotiation, and consensus that has given us a way forward to achieve marriage equality in this Parliament. Labour's leader in the Senate, partnered lesbian mom Penny Wong, applauded the committee's cross-party cooperation in a discussion that, she said, is so often mired in partisanship, acrimony, and finger-pointing. We must now take the next steps to work together, she added, to end this debate and to achieve what is the will of the overwhelming majority of the Australian people. Members of the House of Representatives were said to be reviewing the Senate committee's report.
The most important area of consensus in the Senate report, and perhaps the most contentious, was how to balance civil liberties with religious rights. The committee recommends that ministers and other religious officiants be exempt from anti-discrimination laws if their faith does not recognize civil marriage equality. A separate category of religious marriage celebrants would also be created to allow civil servants who are religiously opposed to marrying same-gender couples to opt out of performing them. However, the ruling coalition government of Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull resolutely refuses to allow its MPs a free vote on any civil marriage equality bill that comes before Parliament. While a few Liberal Party lawmakers are on record in support of equality, the government's further right coalition partner, National Party, helped form the government on the condition that a national popular vote would be the only path to civil marriage equality. A coalition of opposition parties blocked the government's proposal to hold that plebiscite. Turnbull insisted soon thereafter that the issue of civil marriage equality in Australia was dead for the foreseeable future. Stay tuned.
The U.S. State of Washington Supreme Court ruled unanimously this week that a florist who refused to provide services for a gay couple's wedding in 2013 broke anti-discrimination laws. She claimed that doing so would violate her religious beliefs. Baronelle Stutzman had previously sold the couple flowers and knew they were gay. However, she told them that she couldn't sell them flowers for their wedding because the marriage of a same-gender couple was incompatible with her Christian beliefs. A lower court ordered her to pay a $1,000 fine for refusing to serve the couple. Her appeal to the state high court failed because the justices found that providing flowers for a same-gender wedding ceremony did not constitute her endorsement of civil marriage equality. Stutzman had already acknowledged in court documents that providing flowers for the wedding of a Muslim couple wouldn't be an endorsement of Islam, nor would providing flowers for an atheist couple endorse atheism, the justices noted. Stutzman's lawyers, from the far-right Alliance Defending Freedom, which the Southern Poverty Law Center officially labeled a hate group this week, said they'd be appealing her case to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Japan's National Personnel Authority has issued changes on regulations against sexual harassment at government ministries and agencies to explicitly state that discriminatory speech and behavior toward LGBT people is sexual harassment. The new rules apply to some 280,000 federal government workers, and violators will reportedly be harshly punished. Officials at the NPA said examples of such violations would include saying that homosexuals are sickening, calling someone a man-woman, or saying, you're not married because you're gay. Equality activists, who claim that such harassment is pervasive, hailed the new regulations and called for similar moves by local governments and private employers.
The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump continues to send mixed signals on a number of policy positions, including LGBT rights. Trump has already decided to keep the anti-discrimination protections for LGBT federal workers instituted under President Obama. And it was announced this week that openly gay Randy Berry, the State Department's LGBT rights envoy under President Obama, will stay on in that post in the current administration. He'll continue to be the State Department's point person on LGBT rights abroad.
But Trump's newly installed Attorney General Jeff Sessions has pulled the federal government's legal support for Obama-era guidelines on the equal treatment of transgender students in public schools. Sessions has a long anti-queer record, so while equality activists are saddened by the move, they're not surprised. Implementation of the guidelines had been stalled by a lawsuit filed by a dozen Republican-dominated states challenging the Obama administration's assertion that federal civil rights laws banning discrimination based on sex apply to bias based on gender identity. A number of federal courts have already agreed with that analysis. Oral arguments in the case were scheduled to begin on February 21st. But rather than continuing to defend the guidelines, the Justice Department asked this week for an indefinite postponement. Those transgender student protections will apparently never see the light of day because the lawsuit to settle the issue will never be heard. Critics note the irony of the federal agency tasked with protecting civil rights now seemingly working instead to undercut them. Attorney General Sessions is not likely to support transgender Virginia teen Gavin Grimm in his historic March 28th lawsuit before the U.S. Supreme Court. Grimm, who identifies as male, was denied access to the boys' bathrooms on his high school campus. It will be the first time a transgender rights case is heard by the nation's highest court.
Meanwhile, an undocumented transgender woman in Texas has been swept up in the Trump administration's pogrom against undocumented people. Irvin Gonzalez was targeted for deportation right after she successfully filed domestic violence charges against her abusive ex-boyfriend. Gonzalez, a Mexican citizen living in El Paso, was arrested at the county courthouse for immigration law violations just minutes after winning a restraining order against the ex. County Attorney Joanne Bernal told local media that she had been kicked, punched, slapped. She had been chased around with a knife. So she came to our office seeking a protective order and seeking protection from her partner. Gonzalez was taken into custody literally on the courthouse steps. Bernal told the El Paso Times that the tip about Gonzalez's whereabouts probably came from her ex-boyfriend, an alleged abuser, who had been detained by ICE, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, earlier in the day.
Gonzalez may not be a poster person for the undocumented or for transgender rights. A spokeswoman for ICE said she's been deported several times since 2010 for at least 8 convictions on charges including false imprisonment, assault, and illegal reentry. But El Paso District Attorney Jaime Esparza said that the arrest of a Gonzalez sends a horrible message to victims of domestic violence on whether or not they're actually going to have the ability to seek justice in the courthouse. Stephanie Carr of El Paso's Center Against Sexual and Family Violence, where Gonzalez had reportedly been living, said her organization had received multiple phone calls from other undocumented survivors asking if they too will be arrested. El Paso County Judge Veronica Escobar joined Carr and leaders of several other domestic violence agencies expressing grave concerns that the arrest will keep people living with abusive partners from getting help. Abusers often threaten to alert ICE to their battered undocumented partners if they complain to authorities.
But finally, and happily, on a far lighter note, it was revealed this week that the Chinese government, through its state-controlled newspaper Beijing News, is a substantial stakeholder in one of the country's leading gay dating apps, Blued. A reported 7 million users log in every day. That's more than the Western world's Grindr, which is banned by the Chinese government, by the way. Blued reportedly has an astounding 27 million users overall. The Beijing News investment was the equivalent of $4.36 million. As it turns out, the state-backed newspaper invested about the same amount in the company in 2014. Blued has not only been profitable, it's expanded into international markets with e-commerce, live streaming, gaming, and entertainment services. The company's founder and CEO, Gang Li, told reporters that the gay business is a piece of virgin territory in China, and we hope to become a leader of this lucrative market. Political ideology aside, the bottom line is apparently the bottom line. NewNowNext.com reported this week that both Grindr and Hornet, the latter of which already has a strategic user sharing agreement with Blued, have received millions of dollars from Chinese gaming companies that want to reach LGBT consumers.
That's NewsWrap for the week ending February 18th, 2017, produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
Well, folks, we'll be back in a minute with more excitement right after this word.
I'm Kate Clinton, and while I can joke about the political state of our country, it's no laughing matter what Congress could do to our civil rights. An informed community is a strong community. That's why I'm inviting you to tune in to this station to hear This Way Out.
Don't make no kind of sense. Pretty soon there's gonna be no room for sitting on the fence. Better decide which side you're on. It goes down before too long. If left is right, then right is wrong. You better decide which side you're on.
Hey, this reminds me of something. You know, I didn't organize tonight's event, but I did organize another event 50 years ago on this night.
Contrary to what you may have heard, there was more to LGBTQ activism before the 1969 Stonewall Uprising in New York than cringing in closets. Brave homosexuals had begun picketing in Washington, D.C. against discriminatory federal employment practices in 1965, and over on the left coast, a police raid not unlike the infamous one at the Stonewall Inn led to one of the community's first organized demonstrations. The 50th anniversary of that momentous event was celebrated in Los Angeles earlier this month, and This Way Out's Abby Dees got the story inside and out.
Before Stonewall, LGBT people were indeed fighting for their rights. And on February 11, 1967, at the Black Cat Tavern in Silver Lake, a gay-friendly neighborhood in Los Angeles, Alexei Romanov helped organize the first large gay rights protest on record. But you could say that this story begins almost three decades earlier in New York City.
Bryant Park in New York, that used to be a gay hangout. Way back then, my mother was in show business, and there was a group of about nine of us, and we were kids. I was 14. I think it went up to about 15 and down to about 9 years or 10 years old. We would hang out in Bryant Park, and we called ourselves the Trunkers. because we were born in a trunk, theater term. So we called ourselves the Trunkers. And there was a man, to this day, I don't know his name, but he changed my life. I called him Mother Bryant. We all called him Mother Bryant, because that was kind of a term of endearment for a gay man. He was 86 at that time. He would tell us what it was like when he was 18 years old in 1890 to be a gay man. Then he would go for one meal whenever he came over down to Horn and Hardart's Automat down on 42nd Street. And he would sit there and talk to us and tell us about things. And one day there was about six of us sitting there with him. We would have a Coke or a soda. And he said, "When you're my age and ready to leave this earth, if you haven't left your community in a better place than you found it, and the world as a whole, you haven't lived." And it just touched my heart. That has been a key to what changed my life at 14. Mother Bryan.
I would like you to tell me a story of the early hours of the morning, January 1st, 1967.
At the Black Cat Tavern in Silver Lake.
There had been somewhat of a police truce for the past 2 years. Reagan had taken office that night, New Year's Eve, as governor of California. And they raided, I think it was four bars that night. One of the bars was the New Faces. Another bar, I believe, was the Ram's Head Inn. And another bar was the Little Cave, and then the Black Cat. That raid was very violent. Now, no bars had windows to the open because we had to be closeted, and we had to block off the general public from looking in. Nothing tawdry was going on in those bars. Those bars were about getting together with your own community and people you cared about and knew. So at midnight, they played Old Anxiety at the Black Cat. Everybody was there enjoying themselves. And all of a sudden, the police raided the place. They were in there in plain clothes. They were grabbing people. Nobody knew who they were yet. There was no fighting, but the police were beating people in there, beating them down. And the charges that came out of that was lewd conduct, meaning that they had kissed on New Year's Eve for, I forget how many seconds longer than was permissible by law.
This is Abby Dees, and I'm talking with Alexei Romanov about the Black Cat Tavern protest for gay rights in 1967.
And then what happened?
We didn't have computers, we didn't have cell phones, but we had phones. And we had a thing that we called a phone tree. That's where I would call 10 people, and they would call another 10 people, and those 10 people would call 20 people, and it would spread like that. That's how we got word through the community. It may sound like we were very organized, but we weren't.
What was motivating you? Because this wasn't the first time that you had experienced a police raid or harassment, and certainly it was nothing new to the community. Why this time?
Maybe the amount of injury that happened, all the people that ended up in hospitals. That was uncalled for because they didn't fight back. They just grabbed people. In those days, if you were arrested for lewd conduct, there were two charges you could be charged with. There was a major charge, and I think it was 640-something A, and then there was a lesser charge, which was 640-something B. What they were hoping for, that you would plead guilty to 647B because it was a lesser charge and you wouldn't have to register as a sex offender for the rest of your life. So they would plead guilty to the lesser offense, pay a fine, and get out of there as the best they could. And you got to understand, we had a mental illness in those days and we could be committed by our own families. They could just not like what we were doing, and they could put us in the sanitarium for many, many years.
So this was the environment that you were in. You started the phone tree, and then what happened?
The phone tree started working, and it took us to February 11th, 1967, to have the demonstration. There was a bar in Hollywood that was the only place that would allow us to meet, but we had to meet while they were closed.
Was the phone tree saying, okay, we're going to have a meeting, we're trying to get people together? Did you know what you were going to do with
this? No, we got together in order to discuss what we would do. Because you have to understand, we were terrified because if we were exposed and in the newspapers or anything, we would lose our jobs, we would lose our income, we would lose our homes, and our families would alienate us because of embarrassment. Because a lot of people came from other places to be anonymous. That's why the big cities attracted the gay people. Mother Bryan told me in 1890, the police didn't want to put you in jail, but they would come and beat you up with their billy clubs if they knew you were gay every day until you moved out of their city. Get you out of here, anywhere else but here.
So how many people showed up to just discuss what was going to happen?
About 30, 35 people. And it was brought up that 3 months earlier on the Sunset Strip, there had been an anti-war demonstration, and the people were attacked by the sheriff's department, and they were beat so bad. And these are heterosexuals just protesting the war. So you can imagine how we felt. They wouldn't give a darn if we really got injured.
Children born today will grow up in a world without DOMA.
Hello, I'm Robbie Kaplan, the author of Then Comes Marriage, United States v. Windsor and the Defeat of DOMA. And you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
This is Abby Dees, and I'm talking with Alexei Romanov about the Black Cat Tavern protest for gay rights in 1967. 2 years before the Stonewall Inn riots.
There were 500 to 600 gay men and women and people who supported them demonstrating out there.
How did you get from 30, 35 people meeting in a closed bar in Hollywood to 500, 600 people protesting?
Word of mouth. People being sick and tired of being sick and tired of being sick and tired of being treated the way they were being treated.
So what did you decide on? Did you say we're going to stand outside with signs?
First of all, you couldn't stand in one place. You have to move. Otherwise, you can be arrested for loitering. We had people who were giving us information about the legality of different things. We produced flyers that we passed out besides the signs. We didn't chant much. We did a little. But we mainly paraded around, and any one of our flyers that were handed out, if we saw it was dropped, we ran over and picked it up.
What did the flyers say, do you recall?
It told why we were there, the story.
Was there news there?
The only people who covered that demonstration and most of the pictures from that demonstration that you see were done by the Free Press. They were the only ones that showed up.
Did you let the media know ahead of time?
Oh, they knew very well what was going to happen. Very well. They didn't want to cover it.
How long did it last?
To the evening.
And how were the police?
Very orderly, because they were being photographed.
And we see the importance of that to this year.
Yes, yes.
Why do you think we don't hear much about this? Other things that were happening around the time was the next year, the patch on PCH had a protest in 1966 in San Francisco. Compton's Cafeteria, there was a protest. We tend to think everything started with Stonewall, but it didn't. Why do you think we don't know about this?
The difference was there were demonstrations, and somehow a riot makes more news. And Stonewall was a riot. It wasn't a peaceful, organized demonstration. I never want to lessen the importance of Stonewall, but all of these steps are important because they were all footholds.
When you were protesting that night, were you thinking of Mother Bryan?
Yes. And The funny part was I wasn't thinking about Mother Brian in the terms you would be proud of me. I was thinking that I'm so proud to have met you in my teen years to shape my life. I mean, that was the most important person in my life. Usually your parents are the most important person. Well, I had a single mother. Mother Bryant was my adopted father. I just loved that man because he made so much sense. And you know, I'm 80 years old now. And he seemed so old to me back then, where he doesn't seem that old to me now. Because there's only 6 years difference between him and me at that time and now. But there were people like that in our community. There were people who reached out to us kids. And I think there are people who do that now. I've had a great deal of love in my life. And I've loved a great deal in my life. And I want to know people who are younger or even my age that there's still more to life until you take your last breath. Don't give up. Don't stop. Make sure things end up equal to everything else in the world. When one person in a world doesn't have all of their rights, whatever country they're in, all of us don't have all of our rights. It's nice to be acknowledged, but I didn't do it to be acknowledged. What I did it for was my own freedom and your freedom, and the people I learned from as a young person are still here in spirit because you're carrying their spirit. Let me hear you. I hope to be here for the 75th. My name is Alexei Boris Romanov.
And for This Way Out, I'm Abby Dees.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Michael LeBeau, Tanya Kane Perry, and Abby Dees contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. The Tom Robinson Band performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the Estate of Christopher David Trentum, the Gay Chemist Support Fund of Horizons Foundation, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors, for making this program possible. It's always a good time to log on to thiswayout.org and join the family. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WGDR Plainfield, Vermont, Free Radio San Diego, California, 3MGB Malakuta, Victoria, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.